This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, television fans will know that music, the elegant piano and strings introduction to the hit series Downton Abbey.
The British period drama features the fictional Crawley family, their servants in life in their stately home. In this scene, Mary Crawley, played by Michelle Dockery, confronts her sister Sybil, played by Jessica Findlay, over Sybil's unacceptable relationship with a family chauffeur.
What were you talking to Branson about when I came into the yard?
Nothing.
Then why were you there?
Why were you there?
Because I was ordering the motor. That is why one talks to chauffeurs, isn't it? To plan journeys by road.
He's a person. He can discuss other things.
I'm sure he can. But not with you.
Downton Abbey airs on the venerable PBS show Masterpiece, which is produced right here in Boston. It is PBS's highest-rated drama of all time. But Masterpiece executive producer Rebecca Eaton tells us when the Downton script first came her way, she initially decided against putting the show on PBS.
No executive in American television recognized its worth or thought it was important to do. Until Downton, there was a kind of an allergy to anything with British accents. So it came around again, and I heard that Maggie Smith had been cast, and she is one of my very favorite actresses. So I scrambled and discovered it was still available and did the deal.
Downton Abbey has reinvigorated and transformed Masterpiece, a broadcasting cultural icon that's been bringing British drama to American homes for more than 40 years. Rebecca Eaton took the helm more than 20 years ago. The Downton Near Miss is just one of the dozens of delightful stories she shares in her new memoir entitled Making Masterpiece, 25 years behind the scenes at Masterpiece Theater and Mystery on PBS. We talked to Rebecca Eaton about Masterpiece, its past, present, and future, when she visited our studios yesterday. And keep listening, because you might just hear a little hint or two about what's to come when season 4 of Downton Abbey begins in January. Joining us is the executive producer of Masterpiece, Rebecca Eaton. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
For people who don't know the story, I wonder if we could start way back, even before your time on Masterpiece, and just tell us where did this idea come from? How did it get started?
The short version of this story is that the Forsyte saga aired on the thing that was PBS even before PBS. It was way back in 1968, 1969. And a number of people realized that there were shelves full of fantastic British drama sitting in London, BBC primarily, and that there was this new thing called PBS. There was Julia Child and a bunch of college lectures. And how about buying up some cheap British drama and putting it on the air?
Well, this, and by the way, this Forsyte saga was what, 26 episodes?
Oh, endless. I don't know. I've never seen it. But yeah, it went on and on. And
this is back in 1969.
Yeah. You probably weren't even born then.
No.
So that was how it started. And Mobil Corporation, particularly a man called Herb Schmertz, was very shrewd and realized this would make his oil company look very classy. So he gave a lot of money to WGBH. And they then, because I wasn't working on the show, started buying up all these great British programs and putting them on the air.
And what were you doing at this time? Because you actually, by virtue of what, living in London, were quite steeped in British culture.
It was the 60s and the early 70s. Can I remember what I was doing? You know, I was actually working at the BBC in London when Masterpiece went on the air. I had gone to Vassar College. I was a huge Anglophile bookworm. I think I must have been born in another time and lived there. I don't really believe all that, but the affinity that I've always had for the literature, even as a little girl growing up in California, wishing it would rain so it would look more like England. So I had read all these books, and I was in England working for the BBC World Service on a radio show. Mm. I was a production secretary on a science show.
Well, you write very interestingly in the book about how you also got a firsthand exposure to the British class system and the life, which is so often reflected in, you know, current masterpiece dramas. Mm-hmm. Like, you went to old country houses with the landed gentry.
I did make friends. People were very kind to me when I was there and would invite me to come down for the weekend. And I would go thinking, oh, great, we'll go down for the weekend. And I would go down to the weekend and be served sherry and scotch and champagne. And I remember, I was pretty much drunk the whole time. These beautiful houses. But the Vietnam War was on.
Yeah.
And I had protested the war, even though my brother was in the Navy and he was in Vietnam. And after a couple of glasses of sherry at one of these Sunday lunches, when some rather snooty Englishwoman was sort of demeaning all aspects of America, the dirty hippies and the soldiers who couldn't win, I just let it rip and felt my red, white, and blue origins, and felt very, that was the first time I realized my Anglophilia was definitely a hobby, but wasn't me.
Well, there's just so much great drama to discuss here with you, Rebecca, but I actually wanted to start with one that predates your time at Masterpiece, and this is from the original Upstairs, Downstairs, the mega hit in the 1970s. This is actually from the first episode of Upstairs, Downstairs.
Good heavens. Yeah,
indeed. I did my homework, I told you. And we're going to hear a little bit from a character named Sarah Moffat, who's a parlor maid. Mm-hmm. It's not her actual name, as we find out. It's the name that the Bellamys, who own this big house in London, have decided they will call her. And Sarah's played by Pauline Collins. And here's the scene where she is introduced to the other members of the staff downstairs.
Mr. Hudson's addressing you, Sarah.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just that the name's so unfamiliar. Couldn't I be called Clemence if only down here?
Oh, my dears, I've never heard of such a name below stairs. Ever was your mother thinking of?
Search the good book from cover to cover and not find that name.
Lady Marjorie's wishes must be respected.
Clemence. Good name for a filly, I'll say that. But hardly a human.
I think it's a lovely name.
As I was saying, millions would be grateful for mutton once a week, let alone mutton once a day. Wouldn't you agree, Sarah?
Yes, Mr. Hudson.
Fantastic.
Oh, those voices. Jean Marsh, who played Rose, and she created it, and Gordon Jackson, who played Mr. Hudson.
I'm looking at your face. Oh, you're just beaming
wonderful,
right now.
Wonderful.
What
we found that.
What gets me about that, though, is this is in the 1970s, and Jean Marsh, in your book, you write that she had wanted to create Upstairs, Downstairs in response to the Forsytes, because there was no downstairs in the Forsytes.
Yeah.
But when I saw that scene in Upstairs, Downstairs, to me, I just thought, fancier production values today, maybe more fantastic costumes. But the heart of the story is exactly the same as we see in Downton.
Yeah. Well.
I mean, the characters seem so familiar.
They are related. And I would say that scene, it's all in the writing and it's in the performance. And that's the same with Downton. Although Downton, of course, has the Abbey. I mean, Upstairs, Downstairs was all done in a studio. Those rooms were built sets. Upstairs, Downstairs is definitely the progenitor of Downton Abbey. And Julian Fellowes, who created Downton, would say that.
Well, there's so much more to talk about regarding Downton and how it sort of landed in your lap. But I actually want to spend...
And then fell out of my lap.
Get to that. But I want to talk a little bit more about you and Masterpiece in the 80s and the 90s. In 1985, is that right? In 1985, you became executive producer of Masterpiece. And it's an interesting time because, you know, it had been on the air for more than a decade, had already had a fantastic run.
15 years.
Yeah. And I mean, in that time, what... Anna Karenina, Pride and Prejudice, first time around.
Yep. Claudius.
Claudius, one of my favorite television broadcasts of all time.
They had all been on, and Mystery had been born. It had emerged as an entirely separate series. First, Masterpiece in Theater and Mystery were together, but Mystery was 6 years old when I started. Yeah.
So one of the things I do have to talk to you about regarding the early years when you were first executive producer of Masterpiece is, I was going to say the hosts, but really it's the host.
Oh, the host.
This
Alistair.
Man. Yeah.
Alistair.
Good evening. I'm Alistair Cook. We've come now, alas, I don't think I've ever said alas, except under the strain of very strong emotion, to the end of this series of Upstairs, Downstairs. And therefore we're coming to the end of the great, the first, the world, the awful war.
So that is Alistair Cook, actually, from season 3 of Upstairs, Downstairs. But tell me what it was like to work with him.
I have the shivers just hearing his voice. Well, at first, he hardly gave me the time of day. And he lived in New York, and he would come up to Boston to tape his introductions. And I met him my first year, and he was kind of frosty and slightly dismissive. And I thought, oh, great, this is going to be really hard. Because I had known him sitting in my nightie on my couch, watching him introduce Upstairs, Downstairs. Alistair was the best talker I have ever. He would talk about politics, history. He was a fantastic mimic. Yeah. He could do Churchill right down to the ground. He loved Churchill and FDR were his heroes. He could play jazz piano. And he was an actor. So the person that you would see on television was a version of Alistair, that erudite, urbane guy was only part of him.
Well, what you revealed in the book, I didn't know because, for example, that he memorized his introductions to every episode of Masterpiece and didn't have a teleprompter or anything, which, and they were longer then.
Four minutes long, and he would do maybe five of them a day, six of them a day. He would memorize them. He would come in front of the camera, deliver them without a mistake. And God forbid that a camera, we would have a glitch and have to ask him to stop again, but he could do it. And then he would somehow erase all those bites in his head and memorize the next one.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Rebecca Eaton, executive producer of PBS's Masterpiece. She writes about the history of the show in her new memoir, Making Masterpiece, a show that's become such a touchstone of American culture, it's been lampooned by just about everyone, including Sesame Street.
Pip, pip, and good evening. Alistair Cookie here. Me delighted to welcome you to Masterpiece Theater. Tonight, me happy to bring you episode number 793 of Upstairs, Downstairs.
Cookie Monster's one thing, but I asked Rebecca Eaton about the other measure of the show's popularity, all the British actors who became huge stars in the U.S. after appearing on Masterpiece. As I was looking through sort of, especially, you know, in recent times, for example, there are a lot of famous actors and actresses now who were really first introduced to American audiences, I'd say, through Masterpiece. Mm-hmm. I was looking at the list, for example, Hugh Laurie in Jeeves and Wooster, Damian Lewis, who we talked about, who now is in Homeland, but he was in the remake of the Forsyte saga, Benedict Cumberbatch in the new Sherlock.
And even before that, Benedict Cumberbatch was on Things Back to the Ends of the Earth, was a miniseries we did, Small Island. A lot of these people were on for years, and nobody noticed, and then they would have a feature film and be huge.
Even Daniel Radcliffe. Young Daniel Radcliffe.
Little Daniel Radcliffe.
As David Copperfield.
Yes.
Just before he became Harry Potter.
The first drama he ever did. The first acting. He wasn't a trained actor.
We've been talking about a lot of male actors, but there have been a lot of phenomenal female performances as well on Masterpiece and Mystery, and there's one that I want to play for you specifically, and here it is.
This is so much fun.
You know, I spent 8 hours in a room like this once, listening to a young man tell me how he'd killed 3 people. He was explaining to me how he gouged out one woman's eye with a pencil. You think I'm going to go home to Thomas the Tank Engine and Goodnight Teddy after that? I made choices. I spent my life in rooms like this. I'm not proud, but yes, I had determination. It was the right thing for me. It was the right thing for me to do.
That, of course, is Helen Mirren, the phenomenal Helen Mirren in Prime Suspect. That's from the last episode of the series, and she is Detective Jane Tennyson. Now, in the book, you write that you almost didn't take Prime
Suspect.
Can you
believe it? Yes. I read the script, and it was a very strong script. It was pretty brutal in the first story. It's become kind of de rigueur now, but there were a lot of mutilated women. The serial killer was killing prostitutes and doing horrible things. And I thought that our audience, our mystery audience, really, that's not what they wanted, because we were doing the more genteel Miss Marples, and even Inspector Morse was a little more gentle. So I thought, no, this is really too rough for us. Besides, it looks like kind of just a police procedural. So then Granada Television went ahead and cast Helen. And I knew Helen's work from the theater and from a couple of movies she'd done, but she hadn't done very much television, although she did do something with Ken Branagh about D.H. Lawrence years and years ago. Anyway, we didn't air it. So I thought, oh, Helen, well, that could be interesting. But I still said no. And thank God, Henry Becton, who was the former president of WGBH, and he's sort of definitely my mentor, said very gently, Rebecca, are you sure? Are you sure you want to pass on this? Because he'd read the script. So I said, okay, well, maybe we should do it. Oh, thank God.
Well, I'm glad that happened, because you're also equally honest in the book about ones that you didn't take that you wish you had. For example, what was pitched to you as a television version of My Left Foot, which went on to become...
No, it was pitched as the movie.
The movie. Okay.
And I was sent the cassette. It was the end of a very long day. I was in London, and I didn't really know what it was, and I put it in. It was a very bad cassette. It was very dim and hard to watch, and I was tired, and I watched half of it, and I didn't think the American audience would like to see a show about a guy who could only paint with his left foot.
But that, of course, went on. The movie launched Daniel Day-Lewis into the stratosphere, really.
Yes.
And then you also write that, do I have this right? You gave the Pride and Prejudice version with Colin Firth a pass?
This is really painful. Can we talk about something? Yes, I did, and realized, because we'd already done a Pride and Prejudice with the BBC, 6 hours, and it would have been great. And I thought, well, we should spend our money on something else, something new.
So, at the risk of extending your pain a little bit, I do have some questions about sort of we're talking about the cultural import of Masterpiece. And so let me ask you, in the preface to your book, Kenneth Branagh writes that he sees Masterpiece as one of those ways by which, British actors such as himself can measure how Americans see the UK. He has a point, but I actually sort of take issue with the broader point, and that is that, all due respect, you know I'm a fan, but Masterpiece, I'd say, presents a very narrow perspective of the UK. And I'm married to an Englishman. I spent a lot of time in the UK, and I'm wondering why there isn't more diversity on Masterpiece, because the diversity exists in British
Absolutely,
dramas.
Yeah.
I mean, White Teeth, when you put Zadie Smith's White Teeth on the air, that was fantastic. But I can't think of many more beyond that really veer sharply from the frock dramas, as you call them.
Yes, you're right. You're right. And it is a criticism which we have taken. The answer has to do with, it's a complicated answer. We are a niche program. We know what our audience likes, and that's so important in these days of fractured audiences. It's important to do something and stick with it. We have occasionally done things that are more about contemporary Britain. They haven't worked as well. Our audience doesn't seem to watch them. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do them every now and then, and we continue to look for them. But they often are extremely domestic dramas about an issue that might not resonate here.
But I'm hoping maybe the Masterpiece money can shake loose some more diverse drama to be imported from the UK. Couple more questions before we wrap up. Will it always remain so heavily British, though?
I think it will. And I don't.
But why? I mean, there's great American drama.
Well, that's a different thing. over the years, we have tried to do American drama, and there isn't the money. To do original drama in this country, it costs $2 million an hour to do costume drama, and we only pay a fraction of that when we co-produce with the British partners. But I think there is a real appetite currently with PBS, the new administration in Washington, and we are thinking of ways of getting that particular camel's nose under the tent to do, because partnerships are becoming much more international, finding stories that might be Anglo-American, and there are some fantastic ones that we're coming across. So in my perfect world, there would be Masterpiece, which might be all British drama, as it always has been, and there would be an entirely separate series, which would be American Masterpiece, and I would die happy.
Well, since I do have the executive producer of Masterpiece in front of me, I can't let you go without asking a little bit about the juggernaut.
Yes.
About Downton Abbey. And so let's do so by, first of all, hearing just this one little clip.
Putting it bluntly, do you think Robert has thrown in the towel prematurely? Good heavens, what am I sitting on?
A swivel chair.
Oh. Another modern brainwave?
Not very modern. They were invented by Thomas Jefferson.
Why does every day involve a fight with an American?
I'll fetch a different one.
No. I'm a good sailor.
Of course. Maggie Smith as the dowager.
Well, you did a great job in finding these things.
Oh, you know, in Downton, though, it's pretty effortless. You just sort of drop the cursor anywhere,
yeah.
and you
there
find
she is.
Wonderful
yeah, yeah.
dialogue.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a great story that people haven't heard of from behind the scenes at Downton?
A great story behind the scenes. So much of what happens behind the scenes is off limits to talk about. There has been the first year, everybody was just making a TV show. It looked like it would be good, but maybe, you know, just a mini series. And the second year, paparazzi were coming over the walls at Highclere Castle, which is where it was, you know, and the actors were stalked right and left. And I love remembering the first time the cast came over, just to see them in this country, to see them, you know, being stopped on the street. Sophie McShera, who plays Daisy, came, and Rob James Collier, who plays the evil Thomas, who is the sweetest, funniest guy, tap dancing down the street, you know, shopping in the village, just having the time of their lives. That was all in the early days. Now, literally, we have to get them from the airport into the hotel, up to their rooms, because they'll be mobbed.
Register them under fake names,
yes,
I hear.
Yes, yeah.
Can you give us a hint about what's going to come next
Absolutely
season?
Absolutely not. No, you do know it is true that Matthew is no longer with us. There's another character who is no longer with us. I won't say who, but you'll discover on January 5th when you see the first episode. The house is in mourning. 6 months after Matthew's death, Mary is not coming out of it, and everyone is very worried about her. And it's a beautiful first episode about this community.
It's interesting because for a generation now, Masterpiece has been the conduit through which Americans experience a certain brand of British culture and British drama. And you know as well as anyone, you know, the Masterpiece brand was relaunched in 2008, and now the media landscape, you said, is fractured more than anything. And here's one of the perfect examples I see. For example, the original version of House of Cards, the British version, was aired on Masterpiece, right, in the 1990s. And it's now the American version that's really, that Netflix has produced, that's really taken off. Interesting sort of circle there. How is Masterpiece going to maintain its stature, its legitimacy, its place in American culture when we have access to so much television, so much drama, you know, beyond what PBS decides to air?
Well, I think quality will out. We've sort of been here before, never as much drama as before, but we have never lowered the standards of what we do, the best writing, the best acting, the best books to do. If there is competition for it, we're going to lose some. You know, somebody else is going to do House of Cards rather than PBS. Yes, we should have done it. But my sense is there are enough ideas over there. There are enough independent companies making things. There are enough broadcasters who recognize that a platform on PBS is a really good place to show their wares. I think we're going to be fine.
Well, finally, I just want to circle back a little bit to where we started with Upstairs, Downstairs. Because, you know, given that you've been executive producer of Masterpiece and, as we talked about earlier, a self-confessed Anglophile, why do you think that such an appetite in the United States persists for that sort of Edwardian period costume drama?
Well, as I said, I think it was very clear who you were supposed to be then. And, of course, this is slightly romanticized. It was a lot harder to be downstairs than it looks in Downton. But I think what draws people to Downton is the sense of community that they have. The upstairs can't exist without the downstairs without the upstairs. And the way Julian has written it with a tremendous amount of heart, these people are trying to do the right thing. And that's a perfect world. And I think that's often why we watch television.
Well, Rebecca Eaton is the executive producer of Masterpiece. Her new memoir is entitled Making Masterpiece. Rebecca Eaton, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan.
Coming up, a doctor talks about her decision to leave the medical profession due to burnout. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.